Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Today, we're going to talk about an aspect of body image that gets left out of the conversation, and that is hair. We're going to hear Luciana Naldi's story about how she strived for a new definition of beauty after experiencing sudden hair loss. Her story was featured on PBS Stories from the Stage series. Luciana is an educator specializing in teaching sustainable body positive health, strength, and movement habits to athletes. She's a basketball coach and the mom of two sets of twins. Luciana, thank you so much for coming to the studio today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. So body positive health, how did that evolve?
So I became a high school physical education teacher when I was in my early 20s, and I was fresh off of playing collegiate basketball and really just excited to be in the movement space with kids, because I feel like it was such an exciting thing that gave me really a different definition of myself than I had at the time. So I was really excited to move around in that world and give that same thing to kids or help them experience it. And as I got into it, I was also coaching basketball at the time. And so I started to pursue nutrition education for myself so that I could provide that education for my basketball players. And the nutrition world at that time was very black and white. Like, the education that I had was very calories in, calories out. You have complete control over your body and the size it's going to be, the weight it's going to be. There was not a lot of room for considering other factors that affected people's body image or people's weight, their size, any of that. And I also noticed that a lot of people gave more credibility to thin or to more muscular teachers in the physical education space or trainers. And I knew a lot of women of varying sizes in the physical education space, in the fitness world. And somehow, unless they were super thin or unless they were super muscular, they didn't have as much credibility with their people, because the people were like, well, you don't look like what you're telling me to be, so how can I trust you? And I just thought, wow, that's not even close to what we want kids to believe, because most of body size and shape is genetic. There are some things you can absolutely do, but most of it is genetic. But we tell them and we teach them, no, like, you have to eat this way. You can do this amount of exercise. These are the things that have to happen. So because I was exposed to kids from all different sizes, all different ranges, all different backgrounds, keeping in mind also that they all have access to different things. So like, what somebody has access to, what they know how to cook, what is part of their culture, what body size is communicated to them as part of their culture or their ethnicity, all those things come into play when they're thinking about, what do I look like and how do I value what I look like compared to these other parts of myself. So it was really all my exposure to kids in that first, like, probably 5 to 10 years of teaching that completely flipped how I thought about body image and health and nutrition and how I wanted to provide that information for everybody.
But at that time, were you getting a body positive health curriculum from anywhere? Or are you saying that it was just more intuitive? It wasn't in alignment.
No, what I initially believed was not in alignment with what I was seeing. So I very much came from the perspective of, I should look like what I'm trying to teach. I should be thin. I should be muscular. How can I tell these kids to be something else if I'm not that also? But then I realized it's not that simple. And that's harmful to teens, because girls are already thinking all the time about what I look like and thinking about what do other people think about what I look like. So I thought, well, I'm not serving the general population of kids. I'm serving this one population of kids that are already athletic, that are already thin, that are already this thing that we're trying to teach health around being. In pursuing my nutrition education, I first did like a 2-year undergraduate degree that was very like straightforward and more clinical. And then I thought, this doesn't teach me how to talk to kids. This doesn't teach me how to deal with all different kinds of kids. And so I worked with a woman who was a binge eating specialist, and she taught an entire year course around how to coach nutrition habits for people, keeping in mind that there was people who had eating disorder stuff that we didn't know about.
So she just
gave me a broader lens to teach and to talk about food that wasn't like clean, dirty, healthy, like good, bad, like the black and white way that we talk about it. And that really opened my eyes to, I need to have better language for all of the things I'm talking about for health. So I need to pursue different perspectives and ideas. And so I started to read about health at every size. I started to read all the different things, which brought me to your book and to how you were teaching it and how you were talking about it. And so I thought, wow, there's way better ways that I can be communicating this information that's more inclusive, that's healthier for kids mentally, and that reaches more kids on a more positive level.
I'm so glad to hear it. It's just so nice to be teaching the nutrition information in such a neutral way that doesn't have anything to do with size or weight or making foods good or bad. And yeah, you're right. It's like you don't know who you're teaching, right? You could have a kid that has anxiety or genetic predisposition, and really that, you know, the nutrition education coming from a fear-mongering angle is just such a dangerous way to do it, you know?
Yes, and I grew up in an area that was, so I'm Italian, but I grew up in a town where there was a heavy Hispanic population and but partially a indigenous Hispanic population and then an East Indian population. So at the time, the nutrition recommendation was like, oh, you eat chicken, you eat broccoli, you eat these things. Well, that wasn't even part of their normal like diet. You know, that's not part of what they eat on a regular basis. And so to have me tell somebody like, no, it's better for you to eat broccoli than the salsa that you're eating with your tacos, that's ridiculous because that's not true. And so those kind of experiences, I had to learn my community, definitely. Mm-hmm. I had to learn, like, what do they have access to? What do they have knowledge about? What's important in their culture? What do they value? Like, all those things play into why people make food choices. And I think that it's our responsibility as educators to remember that. Like, we're not just telling them, this is how you make a food choice. You have to have all these factors in your life and look at them and say, what's most valuable to me? Why am I making my food choices? How am I basing it? And, you know, adults make them differently than kids. Kids, they're usually eating whatever's provided for them unless they're responsible for getting it for themselves, which then you're looking at where do kids get money?
Like, I'm so glad that you're bringing up that point, because sometimes, you know, the school projects that come home around this stuff, it's like, hey, you do know the kids aren't going to the grocery store, right?
Yeah, like the kid is not out there like writing their list. Yeah. I mean, so I think really I needed a different perspective. Like I needed to open how I was thinking about it. And those first years of teaching really caused me to self-reflect on like, okay, like what are my values around food? Because I grew up in an Italian family. Food was celebrated. Food was something that there was never like restriction. There was never talk of, well, you have to be skinny or you have to be this. Keeping in mind that like I have been what's considered probably like socially acceptable in my body for a long time. I'm the oldest of four girls. We each have different body types. And I think that we had different experiences because we had different body types. Nobody looked at me when I ate a donut and like judged me for it. But I know that some of my sisters, absolutely, because the visual test was not the same. So I thought about all that as I was evolving in my teaching, because I thought, I need to make sure that I'm giving them information that's not harmful to them, and they're not associating what they weigh or what their size is or what they look like as a personal flaw and something that devalues who they are as a person. And so that's how I started to guide my thinking in terms of incorporating all that into my teaching.
Thank you for the work that you do.
Oh. Well, I mean, I'm always learning. Like, I definitely, like, I had, like, a really narrow idea of what I thought I knew. And now, like, you know, like you just figure out I just don't know as much as I thought I did. And you just try to keep learning and evolving. And
I think that's fun, too, though. You know, it's just the learning just never stops.
Oh, that's true.
But so you're saying that the home that you grew up in, as far as food and bodies, it was protective. There were protective factors. Food was celebrated.
Food was fun. Absolutely. Food was celebrated. We were included in the cooking process from an early age.
Oh, that is really cool.
You know, we freely could eat pretty much anything that was available to us. Like, we were not told, like, oh, you can only eat this much of this thing. Like, I mean, and it was always a celebration. It was always something we looked forward to. Like, we ate with my extended family regularly. which, you know, we continue to this day. Like, I have Sunday dinners. We spend Sunday morning with my parents, and then Sunday evening, they come and they have dinner, and I cook dinner. And my kids are a part of that. So I think food was presented in a very inclusive, loving, this is a part of who we are as Italians and as people and as the members of this family. And it provided a way for us to connect with other people, which I didn't realize until I went to college and there was girls on the basketball team that I played with that didn't know how to cook, or they had never had fresh pasta. They had never had focaccia. They had never had the things that we grew up thinking were normal or just common for us. And so food became a way that we could connect with other people, because then it became a way of showing love, which was how my grandmother and great-grandmother and my mother and my father, you know, they would make us special things on special occasions. They, you know, every time we have a birthday dinner or some kind of celebratory family event, they ask us, like, what do you want me to make? And so we just have different connections to food that are also emotional and what I feel is a healthy way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I was just rereading a chapter in our Raising Body Positive Teens book, and there's this excerpt on teaching nutrition. And you made me think of something when you said, you know, the kids are a part of it and they know how to cook. They have those skills. So, you know, thinking about preteen and teens, it's a great time to be, you know, teaching cooking skills. Where did foods come from? There's just so many ways to talk about it that don't have anything to do with weight and size or moralizing food.
One of the elementary schools that I worked at a couple years ago, they wanted to add in some kind of like food education to like the PE part. So I said, absolutely. Like, we live on a farm, so we have like 100 and something fruit trees, and they each bloom in different seasons. So we have fruit in every season. So I picked a whole bunch of fruit and I brought it in, and we did like this exploratory activity with kindergartners. And so they got to like smell it and tell me, what are words that, you know, that you think of when you smell this? And some of them had never seen it before. Yet we live in the Central Valley where fruit is plentiful, you know? So we did that. Then we gave them knives and said, okay, we're going to teach you how to cut this. And they opened it, and like, it happened to be really brightly colored, like orange and reds. And I said, I want you to tell me what you think this looks like. And one of the kids, he opens it and he goes, oh, it looks like the sunset. And I was just like, oh
my God.
I was like, okay, you're like a writer. Excellent. Yeah. But you know, things like that, there was no talk of this is healthy, this is a good choice, and this is a bad choice where, you know, you got your talkies next to you. That's not the thing. It
exactly.
was really like, let's expose them to everything. Let's let them explore their senses, how they feel, what it tastes like, what it smells like, because that's really what kids are interested in at that point.
Yeah. And if we were to teach them that the talkies were bad and that's what's being provided in their home, that's a really harmful mixed message, right?
Oh, yeah. And I really refrain from judging people's choices in general, because I don't know what they're dealing with. I don't know what their options are.
Right.
And that was not how I was in the beginning of my teaching career. I have to say, like, I thought it was very black and white. I thought, no, you make this good choice. And if you make a bad choice, you deal with the consequences, not knowing all the factors that affect people's choices. So,
but what's so interesting is that it sounds like that happened in school, but in reality, your home base and the way you grew up
was
really easy to fall back on.
Yes.
Like, that was more in alignment.
Oh, absolutely.
So it just took a little while to figure out, like,
Yeah, it took me a while.
It's just nice to fall back on, you know?
It is. It just took me a while, to figure out, what does this look like in teaching when this is the information I'm being given and this is the information I'm being told kids have to be given?
Right.
Because it's presented to you like, this is what kids need to know. And then I thought, but is that really what they need to know? Like, isn't it easier to, like, prepare them to be able to make decisions for themselves from a place of feeling good about themselves than to fix them once they realize that I have an eating disorder or like what I'm doing is harmful to my mental and physical health? Like, yes.
Well, and you can imagine in the last years, the trend has been by the time people get into my caseload, so that would mean that there's already an eating disorder, right? The thing that we hear the most often from parents at this time, which is really different 20 plus years ago, is, you know, I just thought they wanted to eat healthier and exercise more.
I could believe that.
And so I'm here to say it's not healthy to only eat healthy.
Right. And I don't think people should feel bad for eating things that they enjoy. Like, your entire life is not like eating foods to hit a calorie goal or to, you know, hit a specific weight. And I think that is the message that's communicated to a lot of young girls. I mean, and young boys too, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it really gets you kind of eating in a way. I heard this one time. It's like making your food choices from a chin up sort of way, like reducing, you know, the food choices to nutrients and calories versus being embodied.
Agreed.
Did your interest or discovery in body positive health come before you experienced hair loss?
Yes. The physical part, absolutely, because I was really aware of how my children were going to view different size people in the world. And my number one guiding factor with changing my language around food and around how we talk about people in general was to be help them understand that like people are more than the body that you're going to see or whatever you're going to see. At that time, I had no thoughts of how hair was separate. Like hair is a part of our body, but it's really not included right. in body image. So
it isn't.
No. And so I was not as aggressive with my conversations around body image, but we did talk about it. But I was much more aggressive and intentional once hair loss came into the picture, only because I was going through that in real time and they were going through it in real time. So before I could talk about people of different body sizes, but there was not an emotional connection to it. So it was like me reading a book to them. We'd read the book, we'd talk about the book, but there was no application to their real life. They didn't see anybody get bullied for being bigger sizes because they were like 5 or 6. They weren't in school yet. They didn't see somebody judging somebody else's food choices. And if they did, they weren't aware of what that sounds like. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't in their world. Once I lost my hair and then I started to go in public, they were very aware of how people were looking at me. They were very aware of how I was responding to it. They were very aware about the words that were being said. So now I had a different real life experience to talk with them about not only body image, but the hair part of it. But I could include it all. I could say, you know, the way that you guys are afraid I'm going to feel when somebody stares at me because I'm bald and I'm moving around is the same way that somebody feels when somebody says something to them about like, oh, are you going to eat that? Are you going to finish that? Or are you sure you should have another cookie? Like, even though the words are different, the feeling people get of shaming another person or judging them based on some part of their appearance is the same. And so that helped them make a connection that, oh, like these are all the same kind of judgments that we don't want to make about people. You can ask questions with curiosity, but you may not form a judgment about somebody's value or worth as a person based on their appearance, based on what you think you know just by looking at them. And so it gave me the ability to have a deeper conversation. So yes, it was there, but not in the same emotionally connected way that losing my hair allowed us to talk about it.
I like that term, not in the same emotionally connected way.
Yeah.
So when did the hair loss start?
So the first time was when I was 19 and I had gone away to play basketball at college and I was super excited about it. And it was just kind of a sudden thing. It came out in like patches, little round patches. And I remember just really noticing it because of where it fell out, which is like right in the middle of my forehead, which is a really hard place to hide. And it really freaked me out. And so I got myself to a doctor in San Francisco. She was a really old lady. And which doesn't matter, but she was really funny. She was small. And I was really nervous to go there because I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell my friends. Like, I felt like this was like a weird thing. Like, if you get sick, people can see it. But if like you lose your hair, you're like, what is that? That's not even, I don't even know how to deal with that. What is that about? You know? And so she came out with like a blown up pink balloon and she rubbed it on my head because she was checking for new hair growth. She was checking to see. Yeah, I was really confused because I was like, oh my gosh, this old lady is rubbing something on my head. I just want her to look at me and tell me this is what you got. We can fix it. Or, you know, tell me something that I can do. I was very action oriented because I wanted it to be over. I didn't want to be the weird girl, the weird bald girl, however you want to say it. And so she said, oh no, this is what this is. You have alopecia. There's different kinds of it. You do not have the universal kind because if you did, your eyebrows would be falling out. You'd lose it all over. So there's different kinds of it. She said, we're going to give you some Rogaine because this is the first like line of treatment. It's a topical treatment. It shouldn't have any side effects. And she goes, rub it on, see if your hair comes back. If it does, I don't have to see you again. If it doesn't, we just kind of progress to another treatment. So I said, okay. And I was just happy to be out of there.
What kind of doctor was she?
I believe she was a dermatologist.
I didn't know until recently that it's a dermatologist you would go to for hair loss.
No, I didn't know that either. At that time, I had like a GP but my GP was down in the valley because that's where I was from. And so I just called, and said, this is what I'm experiencing. They said, we're just going to refer you to the dermatologist right away because there's one near you. And I said, okay. And so I just said, great. Like I have to, I don't have to go all the way home to go to the GP. But no, I didn't know. I went to my GP first because I thought if anybody's going to know, then they're going to know. But there's not really information about that. There's not there's not like a clear path that says, hey, this is where you go for this. So
yeah, I mean, it's not very intuitive to me. It's not something I would have known.
No, and I didn't think about going to my OBGYN at that time because I thought, well, I don't know if that's connected to any of this.
And based on what we know now, that would be a different type of hair loss that would maybe be more common with midlife and beyond.
Right.
Like female pattern hair loss.
Right, which I wasn't even aware of.
Why would we be, right? Yeah.
Not, that information is not really shared because I feel like there's still like some kind of stigma or shame attached with if I talk about this. Then,
totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so you go to the doctor's appointment. She walks out with a balloon.
She does the balloon thing.
She does the balloon thing. You get Rogaine.
Yep, I put it on. Everything grows back.
It grows back.
And it's awesome. Like, I have no issues. I went through my college career. I started teaching. I went through coaching. And initially, she had also said, like, this could be brought on by stress. And I think, wow, like, going away to college could be stressful. But I don't think it was stressful to the point that, like, something was wrong with my body. And then going through my, like, adult life, there was way more stressful things that happened.
So she was kind of ruling out, is it the one that's TE, its initials TE, I can't pronounce it very well, the stress-induced hair shedding, and that's the one that comes back, and usually comes back,
yeah. Yes, she did. And at that time, I think there was not a lot of research around alopecia. So there was not a lot of definitive, conclusive research that says, oh, these five things are generally seen in causing it. They didn't have that. And up through the time that I sought treatment for the second time, they didn't have that or wasn't communicated to me. So,
and the first time around, you were in college.
Yep.
And had you met your husband yet?
So, yes, I had met him, but we were not in like a dating situation. He is 8 years older than me.
Oh.
So, he was actually, this sounds really bad. He was actually a teacher at the school that I went to high school because my dad was responsible for training him in some capacity to be a teacher. And so I knew him as a teenager because my dad was really close in like mentoring him. And so he would come to our house all the time for dinner and stuff like that. But he was more like an older brother that was really irritating to me because I wanted no part of him. Like he just wasn't somebody I wanted to be around at that time. We were just different, age difference, you know,
yeah, 15
and 24 is a big age difference.
Totally.
So yes, I did know him, but not in a dating capacity.
I see. Okay. And so then what about the second time?
So the second time we were married.
How old were you the second time?
I was 37 because I got married when I was 30. I had the first set of twins at 31, second set of twins at 33.
Oh my goodness.
yes. And I had stepped away from teaching and coaching to stay home and kind of wrangle the herd. And so the second time it happened in different spots. And I thought at that time it actually was because of stress. I mean, we had four-year-olds, two-year-olds. I was staying home all day. He was going to work. We went from a two-income household to a one-income household in order to, so I could do that. And so there was a lot of factors, like being a new parent of multiples, like there was just so much that I didn't know. And when it started to fall out, I thought, what? I don't want to do this again. And it was harder to seek treatment the second time because it had to go around childcare. So it had to go around it had to go around my life as a mother. And that caused additional stress for me because I'm thinking about like the longer I put off dealing with this, is it going to get worse? But I can't just get up and go. And I had really supportive, like I had support. Like my parents lived close to me. We had really good family friends who would come and help us and who would watch the babies if I needed to like go to the grocery store, if I needed just to be away. So we had a lot of support and it was still really challenging. And when I sought treatment, I saw a dermatologist locally and he was very matter of fact. He was not somebody who asked questions about how I was feeling about it, what I wanted to do, what had been done before. There was no relationship establishing with him. He was like, this is the first step and this is what I think we try and we're going to do it. You know, we can do it today if you want to do it. Like, I didn't feel like I had time to make a decision. and it was the shots to the scalp. And so I had the little set of twins with me at the time, and they were, they might have been like, I don't know, three or four, maybe two, three. I don't know. They were really little. And so we go into the office, and I said, well, can you, like, what's going to happen? Like, he's going, I'm going to put this shot in your scalp. And then we have to put it anywhere you're bald, because that's where we want the hair to go back. And if the hair sprouts, then we do it again in like 2 weeks and we continue to do it. I'm like, so you're going to just basically pinprick all the bald parts of my head. Then we're going to hope the hair grows from this. And if it does, I have to keep doing this every 2 weeks. And he was like, yeah, that's pretty much what happens. And I was like,
getting the shots every 2 weeks?
Yes. That's what he told me. And so he starts doing it, and I guess I didn't account for like the pain, which I feel like I have a high pain tolerance being, you know, playing sports. Like, I handled a lot of things. I think I was just unprepared, and then it was bloody. And so the little ones are here, and they're, I couldn't send them out of the room because who's going to watch my little kids? And so they start screaming, and they're like freaking out. Cause like, first of all, there's somebody sticking things in mom's head. Second of all, it's blood. And they, and I just had to stop. Like after about 5 or 6 minutes, I was like, yeah, this isn't going to work for me. I'm going to have to go. And he was just very non-understanding about it. He was
so
very,
it wasn't collaborative care. It was sort of like, I'm the doctor, do what I say.
Yes. It was very much like, well, if you wanted to come back, this is what you need to do. And so there was no other options presented at the time. And so I thought, yeah, this isn't going to work for me. Like, this whole way of communicating doesn't work for me. And just this method of care is not working for me. So I went to see like a naturopathic doctor, and she had a little bit of history of like Eastern medicine. And so she ran a whole bunch of tests. She cut more of my hair off, which I thought was ironic because she was running like tests to see if I was missing any vitamins or minerals, or I had, or I had biomarkers for any like serious diseases, anything like that. And nothing came back from that. And so she said, I'm really sorry. I don't have any, like, I don't have any information more to give you about this. And that whole process like took months, because it takes months to, she was in Santa Cruz. So I had to drive to Santa Cruz. I had to take the little ones with me to Santa Cruz. I had to make sure like that somebody was with me when I went into the doctor so they could, you know, make sure the kids were okay. And I had a really good friend who came with me for most of this, which was amazing because she was very understanding. She was available. She had a great relationship, and she just still does with my kids. But it was very helpful to have somebody with you. You know, my sisters did not live locally at that time. So had they absolutely would have been there. But that they were all each in their own lives and kind of going separate ways. So that process of just exploring different things that did not work took me probably 6 to 8 months. And then the final time I talked with a doctor here in Oakland, and I forget how I got referred to her, but she was the very first doctor that sat down across from me and asked me how I was doing, how I was feeling about it, what had happened up to that point.
Oh, wow.
What did I want to happen moving forward? What did I value? Like,
whoa.
Right. Like, which I thought, oh my God, nobody's asking me these questions. I had started in my mind to start thinking about, what would it mean for me to shave it? Or what would it mean for me to, for this to go away? What would it mean if I didn't have hair? But I hadn't voiced that to anybody. I hadn't had those conversations with anyone.
So she partnered with you.
Yes, very much so. And what I felt, yeah, like it was more of a human to human conversation, not like a, you're a problem that I have to solve conversation. And so she didn't give me any treatment. She said, these are the treatments that you've done. This is what's available. This is what we don't know about this, which I thought was also good because
I love that.
Yeah, because she's admitting like we don't have a lot of information. We don't know what the best steps are for everybody.
That's the coolest.
Yeah, because I appreciated that she didn't assume like I am on high, all knowing, and this is what you're going to do.
Yeah.
Like you're not the doctor, the Wizard of Oz of hair care.
Yeah.
So that was helpful because that conversation kind of led me to think about more what I really wanted to come out of this and what was most important for me moving forward, which ended up being the shaving of the head. So that was a really good thing because she really spurred me like going more in that direction. Oh,
because it was more like a partnership, it like made, there was more room for you to decide and kind of tap into what you value.
Yeah. Like what did I want? What was really important to me?
What are your values?
Yeah.
Right.
What was important to me? Was it important to me to have my hair grow back? And if it was, why? Did I want it to grow back so other people were comfortable? Did I want it to grow back because I wanted to be comfortable? Or if I didn't have hair, what would that look like moving in the world for me? What value was that expressing if I chose to do that? Was that a value that was important to me? So like, it really made me just think more reflectively about whose ideas of me do I belong to? Do I belong to my ideas of who I am now? Do I belong to the ideas of what people think I should be at, you know, 15, 20, whatever age I was? And I get to choose. Like, it's okay if it changes. Just because I believe this thing at this age doesn't mean I have to keep believing it if that's not who I am now. And I don't think that I would have had as much freedom or as much empowerment making that decision had I not had that conversation with her. I think that I would have continued to seek kind of just care that replaced what I felt I was missing.
You were married at this time.
I was.
And you had kids. Mm-hmm. You call them multiples.
Yeah,
because this is a new term to me.
Oh, so any, like a singleton is one child.
Okay.
But if you have two or three or four, it's multiples. And so—
whether they're twins or not, it's multiples.
Correct.
It is, okay. Yeah, so I have a singleton and you have multiples.
I do.
Okay. You have many multiples.
Okay. I have many multiples.
Okay. I love it. If I had gotten on that a little earlier, I would like multiples too. They're just, oh my gosh. Anyway, that ship has sailed. Would you have made different decisions about the route that you decided to go if you had not been married, if you did not have kids?
I don't know the answer to that, but probably yes. I think that if I was in a profession that was more focused on my appearance and more judged for my appearance in terms of like you have to look a certain way at a specific time. Yes. I think that I think in the fitness profession you're judged, I'm not really considered in the fitness profession because I am a teacher. So it's a little bit different. It's not like I'm a personal trainer going to a gym every day, presenting myself saying, this is what I look like. So I can teach you to look this way. That's not how teaching is. I think that if I had been younger and really concerned about a relationship and how people were going to view me and that somebody might not want to date me because I'm the bald girl. Like, does that cut me off from an entire segment of the population? I think had I not had children, I would not have as seriously reflected on what I valued and what I was teaching them as a result of my decisions and my actions. And my husband.
Yeah. What about your husband? How was he through this process?
It wasn't like I consulted him on the hair shaving thing. That was not a conversation I had with him. And most of the initial stuff I went through by myself because it was just so emotional. I didn't know how to put words to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my good friend was there. Like, we talked about it and she was there when I cut it. And my sisters, I obviously had conversations with my sisters, but them not being local to me meant that they just weren't there in my daily life. So my friend was in my daily life and I think my husband was always supportive from the background in the terms of like, he didn't ever tell me what to do. He let me take the lead. He would kind of notice how I was doing something and then ask for support or provide support in that direction.
Oh.
So when I shaved my head, I think he was definitely shocked, but he never made any kind of comment or remark other than, okay, that looks great. We're just going to go on from here kind of a situation. He asked me if I wanted wigs, which I had no experience with, and he bought me different types of wigs. He's like, this is not like a suggestion, like I want you to wear it. It's just like in case this makes moving through the world easier for you, then like I want to try to help in that sense. So that was really awesome.
So the fact that you didn't consult him before shaving your head speaks to the way that the two of you were already doing things.
I have always felt like the decisions that I make for myself, while they're going to impact him, I make them with him in mind. But ultimately, I'm going to do, when it comes to my body and my health, I'm going to do what's best for me. And he understands that about me very much. And he's very supportive of that. Yeah.
That's very cool.
It is.
I thought it was
cool.
Worth mentioning.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And then as we got farther into it, I wasn't really aware of how it affected him outside of our house. So once I started moving around in public spaces without a wig and as a bald person, then people really started asking questions to him, and I wasn't aware of it. And some of those questions were out of, you know, curiosity. Some of those questions were out of care and concern. Some of them were just really intimate, like probing questions that I felt were more like chisme or gossip. Mm-hmm. You know, like there was people that wanted to know, like, if our sex life changed. There was people that wanted to know if he found me attractive still. Like, I thought, wow, like, that's really personal. Why would my husband, who's been married to me and has dated me for all this time, why would you think he would tell you something as personal as that in, just outwardly? Like, and why do you think you're entitled to that information is the next question. Like, of all the things that you could ask, that's the question that you're going to ask. Like, is that like the baseline for your relationships? Is this one thing? And I think that
pretty
was
pretty telling.
Yeah, because later when he and I talked about it, I mean, he lost some friendships over it because their comments were unaware, crude, rude, and unfeeling. And so he felt like, yeah, that's not somebody I want to be around. He almost got in a fight a couple times because of it, which, again, I didn't know until later. And there was only two people that were his friends who were men. Because I want to preface that because the women were the ones who asked the question most about like the intimate questions or the attractiveness or the sex.
Oh, that's
and I thought, right. And I was like, huh, okay. That's like, if those are my friends, I want to know who they are. But there was two men specifically that never addressed it in a negative way, always addressed it with him like, hey, are you okay? Is she okay? What do you need? Like, I don't think it's a big deal. I think that whatever you guys choose in your life and in your marriage or whatever she chooses is her choice. And
wow.
Right. And I thought, okay, that's awesome because mm-hmm. I appreciate those two men
yeah.
more now because they are still my husband's friends. Yeah.
So, Luciana, you have a hair care spectrum.
So the hair care spectrum is like the emotional spectrum that I move through the entire time my hair was falling out to the time that I decided to shave it to like present day. So in the very beginning, the hair care spectrum was, I absolutely do care about having hair. When it first started to fall out, I was very like freaked out. I absolutely cared what it looked like. I cared what it felt like. I cared, you know, it feels good to like straighten your hair or like crunch it or be able to wear it in a way that's a part that expresses who you are as a person. I enjoyed that. Even though I didn't have like amazingly thick, gorgeous, like Pantene commercial worthy hair, like I still enjoyed having it. And so the realization that I did care about it kind of shook me a little bit because I thought, oh man, I shouldn't care about this. Like I should be able to like move on past this, but I did care. And so starts falling out. I start finding ways to hide it first. I start trying the treatments. I wore wigs for a little bit. And then after that conversation with that doctor, I started to think, okay, like, can I not care about this? Can it be something that is not that important in my life? All the while keeping in mind that like hair is very different for different cultures. So like, I feel like in the Italian culture, and this was never specifically said to me. This is things that I've interpreted just by what women are held up as beautiful within the cultures that you're exposed to, right? In the Italian culture, long hair is considered very beautiful. In the East Indian culture, hair is considered very beautiful and also sacred because the men in Sikh religion, which is, you know, the majority of the population that I lived around, it's sacred. Like your body is a sacred part of like connected to God. And so men, the Sikh men have long hair that they tie up in a turban. Sikh women have long hair. All the Hispanic women, most of them that I moved around with had long, beautiful hair. So the message was very clearly communicated to the people and communities I moved around in that it's connected to more than just what you look like and who you are. So I thought, can I not care about that? Like, is that something that I can get over? And I started to think, okay, yeah, that might be, maybe is something I cannot care about. And when I finally decided to shave it and my friend came over, we cut it like down to like these little tiny nubs before I ever shaved it just to see how it would feel. And I thought, okay, I can go to this next step. Shaving it was like the explosion of all the emotions. Like it was like, wow, this feels really good. Wow, this is really scary. And I gave the analogy in the PBS thing. It's like, if you know basketball, you know, there's one and ones, right? If you're given a one and one, go to the free throw line, you shoot one free throw. If you make it, then you get another one. So I felt like shaving my head was like making the first basket of the one and one. Like I did the first hard thing that I had to do.
Oh, wow.
Okay. The second hard thing was now going in public. So that was the true test of, can you not care? It's easy to not care in your house when nobody's going to see you and your kids are the only ones that are there. It's a little bit harder to not care when you're going to move around in the community you've always moved around in and people know what you look like before and now you look different. And some of those people are going to approach you and ask from a place of genuine concern. Some are going to approach and ask because they're nosy. Some are going to approach and ask because they want to spread gossip. You know, like there's all these different reasons that people communicate. Going in public was really how I practice not caring because I can't respond to every single person that stares at me. I can't answer every single question about why I'm bald or, you know, and I think I had to move emotionally through that part to get to where I am now, which is indifferent. And I didn't even know there was another part. I honestly, for the longest time, always thought I would either care or I wouldn't care. But I think the ultimate position is the indifference. Only because your appearance, your hair specifically, it's a small piece of who you are. It's not the biggest piece. It's an important piece for some people. For some, it's a really big piece, but it's only a small piece of who you are. And I was really aware of how my children were watching me deal with not having hair, responding to people that asked me questions, and how they were going to shape their own body image as a result of the things that I talked about or how I dealt with it. If I freaked out about it or I got angry at every person that came up to me, I felt like they'd get the message that, hey, what you look like is really important and you have to defend it. It has to be something that other people accept and like and are not freaked out by or not, you know. And that wasn't the message I wanted. I wanted them to know, like, how you choose to move through the world is you. And how people approach you is them. You can choose to respond with whatever you want and whatever emotional bandwidth you have at the time. So like in the beginning, I got asked a lot of questions about having cancer or being sick or having an illness. And sometimes I had the emotional bandwidth to say no, but listen to that person's story because they absolutely did have a story also. And sometimes I would just let them talk about their own story. And sometimes I would just say, no, that's not what it is, but I really appreciate you asking and I am very well. I'm feeling fine. Thank you. You know, so moving through it, the things that helped me were conversations with other women, conversations with, you know, my kids, conversations with people who had a genuine interest in it.
This hair care spectrum, there was no template for you.
No. No, it wasn't like that.
There was no template. It's like it was experiential.
It was absolutely experiential. And it was based on my values as they evolved. Yeah. It was based on the questions my children asked me because my children asked me some hard questions, you know, like, why are you going outside? You don't look like the other moms. Like, that's a hard question to hear.
Yeah.
Like, you want me to blend in. I don't want to have the mom that sticks out. I don't want to have the mom that's different. And that conversation was a really pivotal conversation for us because then we started to talk more about like, well, what are you doing that, you know, or what way are you existing in the world that you think you have to exist, not because you want to, but so other people accept you? Because that's kind of the root of all of this. Like, how are you deciding to be who you want to be? Or are you deciding who to be so that other people are comfortable? And it led to a lot of those kind of conversations.
So the first part of the hair care spectrum is I do care.
Absolutely.
And not short-circuiting it, just letting it be there naturally, right?
Yeah, like I do care. Like I like having long hair or curly hair
right.
or
sure,
I like
as
having
an expression
it.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the second stage of the hair care spectrum is, can I not care?
Yeah, like absolutely. Is this something that is that important to me? Can I move from like making this part of my appearance something really important to being like, yeah, it's not that important to me personally, to what I value, to who I am, to how I want to move around.
And then it's not caring. And now for where you are today.
Yeah.
In this interview, it's indifference.
Yes, it's very much indifference. Only for like a couple reasons. Mostly because I don't think it's the most important thing about us as people. I think, you know, women and people in general are brilliant and creative and amazing. And like what we look like is like one of the least important things about us, but it's given so much attention and it overshadows, like I think of all the time or money spent on pursuing that instead of pursuing the thing that you love or the thing that makes you excited or the thing that, you know, is curious to you or interesting.
Yeah.
So kind of having that like existential realization about yourself. The conversations I had with women about their own experiences definitely pushed me that way. I had conversations with women who were wonderful and really empowered in their own like baldness. I had conversations with women who were sad that felt they could never express that because of the time in their life it happened, because of their spouse's inability to accept it, which was so sad for me. The story of the lady in the coffee shop.
Can you tell
The coffee shop story?
Yes. Can you tell the coffee
shop? Yes, I can tell the coffee shop. Okay. So I had been bald. I don't remember for how long. And I was sitting with my mother in a coffee shop. And it's rare for my mother and I to have time alone because she's always with my kids or with us. And so
because you have multiples.
because I have multiples.
I'm just trying to use my new words.
And this little tiny old woman came up to me. And she put her hand on my shoulder and she looked at me and she said, just so genuine, and she was so close to my face, she just said, "You're so brave. I could never do it. My husband wouldn't allow it." And I was looking at her, you know, because she's so in my space, and she pulls her wig up. She had a wig, like a short grayish white wig on, and she pulls it back to show her baldness underneath, and then she pulls it back down again. And she just kind of starts to cry and then she walks away. And I just thought, oh my gosh, like how long has she been like that? How long has she just had to survive in her life not being who she is allowed to be or wants to be because her husband can't accept the fact that now his wife is bald. And that conversation also really made me grateful for my own husband, you know, because that was never ever something he would tell me or had told me. And I just thought, I hope my own children can just take the experience that I've had and say, you know what, mom did it this way. So whatever I'm having a challenge with that is making me change who I think I need to be, I don't have to do that. I can just make the decisions that best for who I am now and move on with my life and it will be okay. And I'm more than this one thing. I'm more than like my hair. I'm more than my weight. I'm more than my size. I'm more than all these things that kind of we get reduced to.
You know, and it's interesting in hearing the hair care spectrum, it just seems so applicable to so many things.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely.
The way I'm thinking of it is just because of the work that I do, and maybe I have somebody who has a restrictive eating disorder like anorexia and recovers into a larger body. The spectrum works for a lot of things.
Once you know what you value in yourself as a person, then you can look at the areas where maybe you are like giving too much like I care too. And you can be like, okay, like what is the opposite of that? Like what would it take for me to move through this and move to like, yeah, that doesn't really bother me anymore, or move to an indifference type place. And I, you know, people still bring me lotions or doctors or stuff like that. And I think it's all from a place of genuine care.
Right.
But I think that the farther into the spectrum I got, the more I saw what they were doing as something that was genuine care and not like pushiness. Moving along the spectrum for me not only affected how I thought about myself, but it also affected how I thought about people who were approaching me. Those people, in my opinion, the ones who continued to bring me things, even though
I was getting really irritated thinking about them, so I'm obviously not as far along on the spectrum, but you're at the place where it's like, it just doesn't even cause much irritation for you.
No, not now, no.
Luciana, is there ever a good time for somebody to approach somebody else about their physical appearance?
I think it's really dependent on situation and your intent for approaching. I think that someone will, if I agree to enter into the conversation with you, then I'm absolutely open to having it. And I think how you approach me or how you approach anybody really impacts their desire to enter into it. So if you approach me aggressively without the desire to hear my point, but to tell me what yours is, what you see, or how you're judging me based on what you see, my boundary will go up very quickly and the conversation will not continue. if you approach me from a place of curiosity, genuine kindness, and an actual interest in what's happening with me as a person, not just seeing me as a bald person, absolutely. And I know that when I can feel when people are asking me from like a genuine place mm-hmm. and when they're asking from like a probing, I want to get information from you, or I have my own opinion about this that I just want to share with you place. In addition, there are groups of people that I'm going to be more likely to enter into conversations with. I generally answer any question from kids. Kids hardly ever are asking from like a mean, aggressive place. They're asking from genuine concern. You know, like this morning in PE, I had a kid ask me if he could call me Mrs. Baldy because it's so close to Miss Naldy. And I said, you know, I think that's it wouldn't bother me. I am bald. So, I mean, and he wasn't like being mean about it. He was just saying, you know, like these words are really similar and you are bald. So is that something we can do? And I said, you know what, for you, you can absolutely do that. So kids, women, there are certain groups that I'm much more open with, but ultimately it comes down to like, how do I feel once you are approaching me and how are you approaching me? Mm-hmm. And is it appropriate to approach everybody? No, I don't think so. No one is entitled to give you their life story. You know, like people sometimes feel entitled to information about why you exist in the world as you do. And I don't have to justify my existence because you don't understand why I made this choice. And I think that's true of a lot of people. If you're interested in a conversation that's about human connection and understanding humanity more, talk to anyone.
Yeah, because it seems like it could really invite a lot of emotional labor from you.
Oh, I think, yes. And if I enter into that conversation, I'm agreeing to that emotional labor. And I think that's true of anyone that you're asking questions of about a condition or about, you know, asking them to share something about themselves is asking for emotional labor. And they're allowed to set a boundary and say no. And I don't think people should get offended by that. Sometimes we just don't have the bandwidth to go through that emotional spectrum with you at that time. Exactly. It's not because I don't want to. It's just that I just don't have it in me right now. And sometimes people will be really open to it. And I've had really wonderful conversations that have lasted, you know, 30, 45 hours with amazing people as a result. So I think it really depends.
Thanks for sharing that. It just seems like an important point.
Absolutely.
Luciana, thank you for sharing your story with us today. From what I've learned from you is that these experiences can leave us feeling helpless and unsure about how to adapt both mentally and physically because it disrupts our individual perceptions of beauty, desirability, and value. But as you say, I thought this was such a key point, it also quietly gives us an opportunity to redefine and re-examine our beliefs about these things.
Oh, absolutely. 100%.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come here and speak to us today about this topic.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. We'll see you next month.